This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a special psychology. Today I'm talking to Dr. Sophie Browning, consultant clinical psychologist and the lead psychologist in inpatient child and adolescent mental health services within South London, Aldsby NHS Foundation Trust. Sophie will be speaking at the inaugural Judy Dunn National Conference, taking place on November the 9th in Manchester. She'll be focusing on Q's Ed, an innovative CBT program delivered to whole classes of primary school children. Sophie, can you start by introducing yourself?
I certainly can. Hi. Yes, I'm the lead psychologist for inpatient CAMHS at South London and Maudsley, which means managing the psychology input across our five child and adolescent mental health units. I'm also a CBT supervisor for the Children and Young People's IAPT supervisor training program, and I'm part of the QZ team, which you mentioned is our innovative CBT program delivered to whole classes of primary school children.
Great. And what prompted your interest in this area?
The interest really came from the need and came very much from the children themselves. I and colleagues were involved in a randomised controlled trial looking at a CBT package for children with distressing, unusual experiences. And we were targeting children aged 12 and up. And I remember us patting ourselves on the back thinking that this was early intervention. But time and time again, the children were saying, this is not early intervention. You know, we're loving the package, we're loving the ideas, but we wish somebody had told us these things earlier. We wish we'd known some ways of recognizing and helping sooner before problems escalated. I think also at that time, we were thinking that things were moving on quite well in terms of stigma. But again, this was a number of years ago, children in that trial and in our clinical work, we're saying actually there's still huge amounts of stigma out there and, you know, needing again to think about getting in at an earlier stage and trying to influence that. So I suppose the interest came from reports from children themselves.
Yeah. Why is that early intervention so important?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And obviously, secondary school children absolutely have needs as well. But for us, it was about getting in there early and stopping problems escalating. We know the statistics on mental health problems are that there's roughly 1 in 10 children will be experiencing mental health difficulties, and a lot more of those will be experiencing sort of emotional and behavioural difficulties that can influence vulnerability and impact on learning and sort of enjoyment of life. And we know that if these problems carry on, they can increase vulnerability to later mental health problems. So the children were telling us they needed it. We know the research shows that early intervention is important, but also they're the right age when they're young. They're often very open to new ideas. It's sometimes when they start first talking about things and encountering problems, whether it's in the playground or with getting anxious about tests or typical school-based things. But also, I suppose, there's some logistical things, because we were wanting to trial out a universal program. That's a lot easier sometimes in smaller primary schools than trying to target every young person in a secondary cohort. You know, secondary schools are bigger beasts, really. So it can be hard to have a whole school approach in exactly the same way. I think there are people working in secondary schools who are doing some fantastic work, but for our particular package where we wanted to target every child, it lended itself to a secondary school sort of environment. And as I said, because we were trying to get in as early as possible.
I think you better tell me about QZ? What is it and how does it work?
QZ, I mean, it's a whole class CBT program, and it's designed to, I guess, promote mental health and improve emotional well-being of primarily primary school children. And it teaches them to notice the signs when things aren't right. And the CBT bit's about learning that thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are connected, and that children can learn practical things to manage life's typical ups and downs, whether those are at home or at school. It's 8 sessions, and it actually happens in the classrooms with teachers present and sometimes dinner ladies or playground monitors, whoever the school wants to be around. Delivered at the moment by clinical psychologists and CBT therapists. And I think there have been other universal approaches before, but we knew that engaging 30 children at any one time was not going to be an easy task. So we wanted to make it as energetic, lively, interesting as possible to engage the children and to use sort of multiple platforms for learning. So it's quite multimedia, it's very multimedia. And we also have our characters, which I think with that age children really helps us to get the points across in a relatable way. So maybe I'll just tell you about two of them. Ed's our main character. Ed's his name and stands for education. And then his best friend is Chloe, and Chloe's a chameleon, and chameleons change colour depending on how they're feeling. For example, if they're frightened and want to hide, but children aren't chameleons, so how do people know how we're feeling? And so we use the characters to go through everyday situations that the children may face, and initially the children are helping to guide the characters through their thinking and their feelings and what they might do and how they might learn new repertoires of coping skills. But more and more as the program goes on, the children are relating it to situations that they encounter, thoughts and feelings that they're having. And I can tell you some of the ways we try and operationalize some of those CBT concepts into practical hands-on role plays or exercises that the children can do to embed the learning. And we also have a website and some apps in terms of the digital developments that help to the children to rehearse the things they've learned in between the sessions, and a workbook and handouts that go home for parents. So there's a lot of extra things that wrap around those 8 face-to-face sessions, so that the children and the school can, in a CBT way, be learning, developing and embedding the skills in between each session.
Right. And what are there some examples of some real life concerns that tend to arise during these sessions?
Yes. Yeah, so the children, we talk about how to catch your own thoughts, because obviously that can be quite a difficult concept to be thinking about your own thinking. And one way we sometimes choose to illustrate that is with Ed's amazing thought machine, which is actually trade secrets here, an adapted version of Ellie Fun, the children's game that a long trunk blows air up in sort of quite high pressure. But we've adapted it so that it blows little tiny bits of tissue paper into the air. The tissue paper have words written on them. We will be talking about something that somebody might be struggling with, like trying to do a difficult piece of work. That person that we've role played might be having some helpful thoughts, such as, this is difficult, but just keep going, you're doing well. Some unhelpful thoughts, such as, you're rubbish, give up. And we get the children to actually physically catch these thoughts with nets, physical nets, and then to look at those thoughts with our oversized magnifying glasses, and to be sorting them into a helpful bucket and an unhelpful bucket related to that scenario that we've created for them. So it's really good fun, but actually it can be a real ka-ching moment that means every time we come back to talking about catching our thoughts and looking at our thoughts, children have sort of got some of those ideas in mind. We also, just to give one other idea, they love, because we touch on unusual experiences, because we know those are actually very common in children, often not problematic, but can be problematic and make children more vulnerable to later problems. And so we might use illusions to talk about how our amazing brains help us do all sorts of things, but also how they can play tricks on us and produce unusual experiences. And a simple way we might talk about that is also we might have different liquids for the children to taste, and there might be a bright yellow liquid that they think is going to be lemony, but actually we flavoured it with raspberry. And so we play around with how our minds can play tricks on us and how our expectations of things, and then we might be relating that to thinking somebody's thinking a particular way about you in a playground, whereas there might be a very simple explanation. So I suppose that's just two examples of using quite creative, fun, engaging ways to get us into talking about some very real and meaningful and hopefully effective different ways of managing it.
And what's the type of feedback you get from the children who have participated in the programme?
We've had incredible feedback from the children. They absolutely love it. They, as well as we gather feedback before and after, and we have formal questionnaires that we give them, as well as the more standardized measures. But invariably, they also write letters or emails and things talking about what they've got from the program. And it tends to be about them understanding that things they're experiencing are normal for some and feeling less scared about that, or that they feel more able to talk about or recognize things. Or for a lot of them, it can be one or two really simple ideas that have made a huge difference for them. And some of the most moving stuff is when they say, you know, I'm really using my handy breathing and it's stopping me getting angry and stopping me hitting out. Or I've taught my mum handy breathing and it's really helping her when she feels anxious at home. So they're talking about how it's helped them individually, but they're also talking about how it's helping them understand each other, and even how they're using the strategies when they get home and in different environments, even outside of the school setting. I suppose as well, it's as well as looking at our own measures and things, what's really nice is when we hear how the school have then sort of taken the ideas even further. So maybe because we're not prescriptive about how to take it further, but each school tends to do it in their own way. So maybe they have a whole project on it afterwards, whole school project, or they run assemblies where the children have invited the facilitators to come along. And when they've done a summary for the rest of the school, showing the things that they've learned and that they valued, and that can be really moving, actually. And as well as it giving us real hope that they're carrying on with the ideas and liking the idea that it's helpful for them, and also that they think some of the ideas can be helpful for to share with family and friends.
So although the QZ programme itself is delivered by highly skilled practitioners, from what you're seeing, the school is then able to run with some of those ideas in some way.
Definitely, because it's really important that we have the teachers present during all of the sessions. And they've been brilliant about that, because we know how busy teachers are and how many things they probably need to be getting on with. But the facilitators really emphasize the importance of them being there for lots of different reasons, really. One of which is because they then pick up lots of the language, the ways of talking about things, the strategies. They can see which ones the children tend to be the most excited about, which varies from school to school, class to class, which means that they can then encourage the children to be using those strategies in between sessions. Also, they will then use some of the ideas with other classes who may not have been directly involved with Clues Ed. But it also, a lot of teachers have said it's sort of shifted their focus and understanding, maybe when they've thought a child is just badly behaved, but then they've been amazed when maybe that child has opened up about maybe different sorts of feelings that are going on for them, and there's been a shift. It's really important that we've had the teachers there, and they've been brilliant about embracing it and taking the ideas forward.
Great. And which children tend to benefit most from learning and practicing, I suppose, these are sort of resilience building skills? are there any groups that benefit in particular?
Yeah, and resilience is a funny word, isn't it? Because we've moved away a little bit from the word resilience because I think it creates a lot of confusion. We talk more about early intervention and awareness and psychoeducation and building up coping strategies. And definitely what we're finding so far is that the whole class tends to benefit in a general way in terms of well-being, being more aware, their knowledge, and breaking down stigma. But definitely the biggest change we're getting is in who we might label the more vulnerable group, who score higher on the emotional distress or struggling with behaviour. And it's those groups who are making the greatest change.
How do you know what those benefits are? How has QZ been evaluated?
That's another good question. So we haven't yet done a sort of large scale randomized control trial, but we've done multiple other ways of evaluating, including sort of delayed baseline where one group gets it and then we wait a while and then another group in the class, in the school gets it and we evaluate. We have various different measures. Some of them are standardized measures, for example, of well-being. There's a measure called the Children's Outcome Rating Scale or the CAWS that we use. We also look at emotional and behavioral difficulties with the Me and My Feelings standardized questionnaire, but we've also adapted a quiz to tap into knowledge related to QZ content and aims. And we have measures that the teachers complete on more on emotional things and classroom behaviors. And then as you were referring to earlier, children, parents, and teachers complete feedback forms after QZ to help us evaluate more the sort of acceptability and accessibility side of things, as well as the effectiveness. And we are extremely encouraged by what we're finding so far in terms of the pre-post change.
Great. And what about, I mean, from the research, how enduring do you believe these methods are in helping a child maintain good mental health as they move into adolescence and beyond?
Yeah, so that's something that we really would like to focus more on and evaluate more formally. So what we have so far is pretty anecdotal. We've gone back 2, 3, 4 years to our initial pilot cohort and one of the school, and all we have at the moment is anecdotal reports from the teachers who have seen those children move forward into secondary school, who have been incredibly positive about things that have continued. We went back to one school 18 months to 2 years afterwards to see what they had retained in terms of their knowledge and understanding and what they were still using in terms of the coping strategies. And we were bowled over by how, I mean, they'd remembered and retained pretty much all of it. And the vast majority were still using and still finding the coping strategies effective. But we haven't done a formal piece of research on that yet. We're at the moment looking more at the pre-post for the program. But definitely that's going to be really, really important to look at those longer term outcomes.
How widespread is QZ? How many schools have been helped, or if you can quantify it in some way?
No, that's fine. So we've worked with over 4,000 children so far. Mostly that's been in the London and South East, although we've worked with some in Hertfordshire, and we're just about to do some in Kent and Bromley, but mostly with local schools. And I think that's between sort of 50 and 60 schools so far, but probably approaching 4,500 children.
Right. And will the scheme be rolled out nationwide?
Well, we would absolutely love that. It's our dream that every child in the country could benefit from QZ, and certainly, you know, the schools that we've been working in are huge advocates of that as well. So we are currently exploring different ways of scaling up and getting QZ to more children. There's various ideas around that, including more blended approaches to have some face-to-face and more of the digital online resources as well, because obviously there can sometimes be access issues. And I think that would certainly be worth building on. But absolutely, we would love to scale QZ up and to make it more available to more children.
Just taking a step back, can you explain in a bit more detail why this sort of whole school approach is so important?
Yeah, I think it's because, you know, it does have the potential to benefit every child, would be my first answer to that, really. I think there are things in there that are not just targeted when things have reached a level that becomes problematic. But, you know, with true early intervention, you are trying to prevent problems from escalating, and especially with the way things are at the moment with thresholds for CAMHS and things increasing, targeting everybody and trying to help everybody improve their well-being, improve their repertoire for coping can only be a good thing. But if you're also helping those children who are already struggling, are already vulnerable, and have where it's likely that that vulnerability is only going to increase, you can then help them in a very normalizing and destigmatizing way by doing it as something that you're saying, do you know what, this is for everybody. This isn't just for one individual child who needs to be pulled out of a class to get some specialized help. And I'm not saying there isn't a place for that. There absolutely is sometimes, but it's about saying this is something that can benefit everybody. And that's certainly what we're finding in terms of the outcomes. But I as I say, I think the sort of helping with the stigma and normalizing it is part of that as well. And also, I mean, children get really good at recognizing things and helping each other, which is really important. And within having a large group of them doing it at the same time sort of maximizes the capacity for that.
Right. So it increases the understanding between peers, even if they are.
Absolutely. And then being able to help each other and be supportive of each other, which can be really helpful, I think.
And does it destigmatize mental health even amongst some of the adults who are or to approach certain pupils differently, perhaps, because they have a greater understanding?
Absolutely. And that's something we've had really quite positive feedback about, and people being very honest. Because obviously that hugely varies. Some people have huge amounts of understanding around that and others maybe less so. But we've got a lot of really nice feedback indicating that we are seeing some of those shifts as well. And it really does seem to just, you know, promote those ideas and positive practice and thinking around mental health, as well as we say, encouraging those shared learning opportunities between children, which is really important. And if you're working with the whole class or indeed the whole school, it's just more of a chance to embed that way of thinking and practice within that whole culture.
Right. I want to talk a bit more with QZ. I understand it's being developed as well for children with autism spectrum disorder and for children with physical health conditions. And I want to take those separately. Can you say a little about each of the innovations?
I certainly can, yes. I mean, those are both very new innovations. So maybe I'll start with the one for ASD, which has been really exciting, which we've piloted and then run a couple of other follow-up groups, which seems to be going really well at the moment. We piloted it in conjunction with our colleagues in Croydon, with the Croydon Neurodevelopmental Team. And we knew that we'd have to do some adaptations from our usual program. So they tend to be shorter sessions, and we have more sessions for the children with ASD. And we also have built in formal parent sessions, whereas in the QZ usual group, we have resources for parents and we offer the school parent sessions if they wish to take it up. But for the ASD group, these form part of the core program. And then we've included some new activities, which I suppose have more of a practical emphasis and more visual aid to offer different and more flexible means of communication. And we provide, I suppose, there's a lot more summarizing and repeating of probably less concepts, so that we're really embedding some of the ideas. So the pace can be a bit slower. But we've been really, again, it's very, very early days, but we've been really bowled over by how the children have thrown themselves into it. And probably one of the biggest things that's come out of that has been how the children have used the groups to form friendships with each other. And there's been a lot of feedback about how much they just enjoyed being together, doing those activities together and learning together. But we're also getting lots of reports from the children saying improvements in what we might call knowledge, such as their emotional literacy, their coping, their well-being behaviours. But they're talking in terms of managing difficult feelings, feeling better about things, feeling there's some strategies they can use to manage behaviour at school or better able to look after themselves. But very early days, but very promising. And it's just been really nice to adapt it again, to have it as a group package, but for a specific population.
Just before we move on to physical health conditions, can you just explain a bit more about how the parents are involved?
So they have... Yeah, they have two parent sessions. One of them's at the very start and one's at the end of the programme. And the aims of that is we want to share what the children are learning and the point of what we're trying to do with the parents to help embed any strategies that the children might be finding useful so that it's not just contained within the sessions. So we, at the beginning, we'll just be outlining the concepts and going through what we're going to be doing and why and how parents at home can support. And at the end, we're telling the parents in detail about which new skills the children have learned. And it could be tailored because, you know, I think I've not facilitated that group myself, but I think the facilitators would be saying that the different children have picked up very different things from the sessions. And so it's very individualized in that way. They're all picking up lots, but they're different things. So making sure each parent is aware what their particular child has embraced in terms of the new skills and how they can help to encourage them to carry on using those skills after the sessions are finished.
And for the more general child population, you said there were also parent sessions.
Yes, so right? They haven't been done in every set at all. All parents, so the children get the workbook to take home and all parents get a session by session, really nice, bright, informative summary of what the children have learned and the skills we're working on and what they're being asked to practice. But that's very much in paper format. Parents can also access the online resources with the school's login so they can have a look in more detail at things there. But in some schools who have requested it, what we've been able to do is to offer a sort of one-off or occasionally two additional sessions for parents to hear more about mental health, what we're trying to do here, the sorts of strategies we're trying to encourage amongst the children. But those have been sort of add-ons where the schools or parents have felt that would be particularly useful rather than being a core part of the programme.
Right. But clearly the idea is to disseminate these skills as widely as possible into the community.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, moving forward, having this, it's just logistically whether you would always be able to get high numbers of parents of all 30 children in each class to be able to come. It's a lot easier with a small group of 9 or 10 children in a more targeted way, say with the ASD group to do that. But, you know, parents are so busy and often very spread out geographically. So certainly something we'd like to offer more of, but probably unrealistic that you'd always get all 30 parents being able to attend each session. But it's definitely something that we'd like to do more of.
Let's go on to children with physical health conditions. What's happening there?
Yeah, so that's quite exciting, really. We were approached by senior medics at King's, one who works with children with chronic liver disease and one who works with children with diabetes, as well as one of the paediatricians over there who'd heard about QZ locally. And together, in collaboration with them, we were just really keen, and we've got a bit of funding to do a pilot to look at how we can help children with physical health problems who are accessing King's that we know face particular challenges and maybe struggle to attend school. We wanted to increase the reach and scope to give these children access to learning ways to look after their physical well-being, as well as when they're struggling with some really challenging physical health issues. And I suppose that, you know, the Mental Health Task Force, et cetera, quite rightly is calling for more integrated physical and mental health care approaches. So it felt a really nice way of trying to do a real collaboration of the sort of physical and mental health needs with a very needy group. But we can't deliver that in the same way. The mechanism obviously has to be difficult. These are not one group of children in one school. And access issues, you know, some of these children can be very unwell, can be a real challenge as well. So what we're planning to do is have, again, that blended model, but a lot more of a focus on the digital aspects, the sort of e-learning package. So the idea would be is that children who are accessing KINGS with physical health difficulties would have access to the workbook, access to the online sessions, which would be very similar in content to what we're delivering face-to-face, but it would be delivered online with the workbook. But the really nice idea is that whenever the children are attending their outpatient appointments at King's, there would be, because we'll have weekly drop-in sessions, weekly queues, drop-in sessions in the outpatient department over at King's, that the children would be able to just drop in whenever they're there and rehearse live with face-to-face people the strategies that they're learning and do some of the exercises that we do live in the classrooms at the moment. But it would be embedding what they're learning via the e-learning, if you see what I mean, and via the workbook.
And that's being piloted at the moment, is it?
It's yes. So we've just got the funding and we're just planning with our medics over at King's and thinking about the best way of managing things logistically. But it's something we're really excited about because we know that children living with chronic illness, obviously there's such a range of ongoing stressors that are difficult emotionally, but also increase their risk of developing mental health problems themselves.
Right, so it really comes back to nipping things in the bud early.
Nipping things in the bud, getting in there early, absolutely.
Just moving back to some of your, you mentioned this at the beginning, you talked about how you UET for adolescent psychosis and for distressing unusual experiences. I think this was some of your a special interest of yours. Can you say a little bit more about that research and whether it's fed into this at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, we've just finished a randomized controlled trial, which was called Cues Comes In Again. It's called the Coping with Unusual Experiences study. We called it the Cues Plus, and that was for 12 to 18 year olds. It's transdiagnostic, as in, you know, not just CBT for psychosis. This was a package for any children, no matter what the diagnosis, who were referred to our four local CAM services, who were also experiencing any what we call distressing, unusual experiences, such as hearing a voice that other people can't hear or seeing something that other people can't see. So if they were having those distressing, unusual experiences, then they were offered to be part of the study. But we delivered it via training up a local workforce, so training 30 CAMS therapists over 2 years and recruited 122 young people to that. I suppose it came, again, from knowing about the need, but also the NICE guidelines recommend that we're doing individual and family-based psychological therapies for children who are under 18 who have psychosis or indeed psychotic-like experiences or unusual experiences with distress, as we now call them. But there's not been very much research into that at all. So it's based on the adult literature and adult research. So we felt passionate about actually testing out. It's something that we'd done in a small way before and wanted as a group to test out whether this could be effective, a CBT-based package targeting those distressing, unusual experiences as an add-on to standard care. So we trained local CAMHS therapists and then looked at whether you could get improvements on top of usual routine CAMHS care.
And can you say anything about the sort of interim findings? Or
I can say a little bit. We're still at the stage at the moment of sort of analysing any final results. What we have found is that obviously it's been feasible to do. We know that screening for unusual experiences and distress in routine CAMHS is feasible. We know that the training with supervision can be successfully delivered. And we are definitely seeing some small improvements, but possibly not reaching those high levels of significance. But we're at very early stage of looking at the results. It's likely that we might then need to make some adaptations and think next about how to get even further with that, but it's very much in the early stage of analysis at the moment, but we're hoping to be able to report on that quickly. We know children, parents and therapists really enjoyed the CBT package and felt they got a lot from it, and so we're analysing results at the moment, but we're also keen to be disseminating resources and doing more teaching and training locally in terms of skilling people up to be working with these populations.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about training people up, because I know you teach, you train and supervise in CBT both within and outside of your trust, who are you disseminating these skills to? Is it to your colleagues and within CAMHS, or to teachers, GPs?
It's quite a range, really. I mean, stepping away from just psychosis, I suppose my CBT, we train local clinicians. I train on the CYPI UP program, train local courses for trainee clinical psychologists or our local junior doctor training, but also for the more specialist things such as CBT psychosis training via often different services will come and request a more formal block of training in that, or in collaboration with our colleagues in King's doing a postgraduate diploma in CBT psychosis, which clinicians from all around the country have attended and sort of attending and teaching and training at more international conferences as well. On a range of topics, including psychosis. We've taken some training for teachers, maybe more in terms of mental health awareness, knowing how to recognise things and when to refer on. I haven't personally done individual training with GPs, but I think that's really important. And that is something that other colleagues of mine within South London and Maudsley have been focusing more and more on recently. Again, I think in the spirit of that, getting in there early and making sure that people are able to spot and help at an early stage, but also knowing who and when to sort of triage and refer up.
You're speaking at the Judy Dunn National Conference. Can you give a quick sort of summary of the areas that you hope to cover at the conference?
Sure. I suppose some of the things we've just been talking about now, I'd like to sort of make a case for early intervention and why that's so important. I'll be talking about some of the literature in that area. I'll be outlining the different sort of ways of working with children in this area, including universal approaches to sort of mental health and well-being. I'll be bringing QZ a little bit more to life for people as well, and giving some more examples of that. And probably I'll mention the Q's Plus and the CBT for psychosis work. And I suppose you mentioned how that ties in with QZ. And although that's quite a specialist area, because we know that unusual experiences are actually very common in children, and that's the bit where we have a couple of sessions in the middle helping children understand about that and ways that they can either reassure themselves that things are normal or how to recognise if they need help, and either things they can do themselves or when to talk to other people and get a little bit more help with that. So I'll be touching on that as well.
And you said it was from with adolescent psychosis that you came to realise there was a more general need. Is that right for QZ?
That's right. Yeah, it was our very first pilot when we were doing a small, successful CBT package for children with distressing unusual experience. It was the pilot to the recently completed RCT. And we'd brought the age down to 12, but it was then that these children were saying, well, actually, I would have liked this to have been a lot earlier, you know, that I've been, you know, experiencing these difficulties for a very long time and would have liked help with it a little bit earlier or a lot earlier. And so that was sort of, and from our, not just from that really, from our normal clinical experience day to day as well, myself and the other people who are involved with QZ. It's just a familiar story, really, that by the time children reach services, often they have been struggling with things for quite some time and are themselves saying that they would very much like to be getting help a bit earlier.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked? We've covered a fair bit of ground, but there might be
something. We've covered quite a bit. I suppose it's just also about not underestimating children. I think we maybe did that a bit at first. I remember when we were talking about how to adapt some of the evidence-based CBT, particularly for anxiety, that we were going to use in the program. We had a number of conversations about how these were very young children and it was likely to be CBT with a very big B and a very small C. And we know the evidence base is out there that behavioral approaches are often what work very well with young children. I don't want to challenge that, but just to say we've been bowled over by how these young children have been able to take on some of these more cognitive concepts and really understand them and make use of them. So I suppose that's just one example, but in general, just about not underestimating them and their ability to take on new ideas and run with them.
Mm. Is there a sort of take-home message for people listening to this podcast?
Early intervention, and don't underestimate them.
Right. Sophie, thank you so much. Right.
No problem.
Dr. Sophie Browning will be speaking at the Psychological Interventions for Children and Families inaugural Judy Dunn National Conference, which takes place on November the 9th in Manchester. You can find details on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and on Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.